Welcome to IIEA's Insights with me, Dan O'Brien. The deterioration in European security since Russia's invasion of Ukraine 2 years ago is without parallel since the beginning of the last Cold War in the late 1940s. Geography might give us in Ireland some belief that we're insulated from the conflict and even an escalation of that conflict. Those countries closer to Russia are in a more precarious situation. To get a sense of how threatened some of those countries feel, we are joined today by a Ukrainian, a Pole living in Brussels, and an Irishman who's a longtime resident in Helsinki. Owen McNamara is a research fellow at the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, specializing in security in Northern Europe and NATO, among other topics. Robert Bestel is a senior fellow at the Security and Defense Department of the Center for Eastern Studies in Warsaw, and both a former Polish diplomat and NATO civil servant. Elena Tregub heads the Secretariat of Ukraine's Defense Anti-Corruption Committee and has previously worked for her country's Ministry of Economic Development and as a lecturer of economic in international relations. Excuse me. Thank you all for joining us. I think it's appropriate to go to Elena first, given the situation in your own country, Elena. Looking to the future in terms of Ukrainian security, could you give any sense of whether or not Ukraine and Ukrainians can feel secure with a neighbor like Russia? In other words, what sort of guarantees would Ukraine seek? What sort of regime change in Russia do you believe might allow you to have some sort of secure coexistence with your neighbor?
Well, it is very clear for Ukraine that there is absolutely no security for us having Russia as a neighbor. And even though we can imagine a regime can change in Russia, but even with that, still their chances for security are very bleak. Therefore, the strategy of Ukraine is to receive this security either through membership in NATO or through creating a defense mechanism which would deter Russia from future aggression. Their goal of the Russian state is the elimination of Ukrainian statehood, Ukraine as a nation, into absorbing Ukraine into Russia. And it's very clear, and this goal has not changed for now centuries, and now we see in the face of Vladimir Putin another escalation. Therefore, Ukraine right now, as you know, is trying to sign a series of security guarantees bilateral with key European allies. Those security agreements, they are not really, we call them guarantees in our colloquial speech, but they are not really guarantees. These are just agreements that say that we become partners, allies, and where if the war continues, and even if the war doesn't continue, those partners will give us security assistance, will give us weapons, and Ukraine in turn also promises to give some of its defense capabilities, some of its knowledge, weapons, whatever is needed in case those partners will be attacked. And now that's the way we're going. But of course, Ukraine has always hoped for NATO membership because many experts believe that there is no alternative to security guarantees to NATO. There is no alternative. And unfortunately, Ukraine has never been invited into NATO. Ukraine has been applying to NATO since 2008, but different leaders of the West and NATO leaders, they always responded to us that the door is open theoretically, but in practice for you, not really. And this is because Russia has always tried to scare other countries, to put pressure on those countries, on US leaders, on German leaders, telling that there is no way you can admit Ukraine into NATO. And the NATO membership was maybe favored by 50% of our population, by 60% on the eve of invasion, but now it's around 90%. So everybody in Ukraine wants to, so to say, install this it's like a lot, it's like an alarm system. It's like a protection system from your neighbor who is a serial killer. If you leave somebody next to somebody like very dangerous, you would want to live in a home which is protected, where you have high fence and so on. So that's how Ukrainians see NATO. But unfortunately, we're not able to become part of that security framework. And therefore, of course, we will be now probably we are moving towards militarization of our society, of our economy, and creating partnerships with our allies.
And Olena, President Macron recently said that it wasn't unthinkable that NATO forces would be on the ground in Ukraine. Is that something? What are your thoughts on that?
Of course, the thoughts of Ukrainians that we, of course, would want to have NATO boots on the ground in our country from day one of full-scale invasion, and even before full-scale invasion, Ukrainians always wanted to have internationals step in to protect us. Basically, it's very simple. We are the victim. We're being attacked by aggressive state, and of course, we want their international order, the international community to protect us. But because, as you know, Russia has nuclear weapons, nobody stepped in and we were not protected. However, right now we see that for 2 years, Russia has been, from time to time, expressing nuclear threats, including, I think, yesterday again, Putin expressed it. And he does it to basically deter the West from using boots on the ground. But he also expressed those threats about long-range weapons, about tanks, about planes, but nothing happened. Gradually, we were provided with those means of assistance, and nothing happened. And therefore, now it's not unthinkable if a situation deteriorates in Ukraine, if Ukraine is, under threat of being defeated. I don't exclude that there will be boots on the ground, and probably not in the fighting capacity, but in other capacities. And just. You know that informally, there are already different representatives from different countries of NATO members who are helping us on the ground. But it's not like it's like small numbers, really small numbers. But Ukraine, of course, would welcome some serious contingent, of course.
Okay, good. Thanks. Robert, can I go to you? Elena's raised the issue of nuclear weapons. I want to raise that issue with you in terms of Poland and whether or not the situation has become so serious that Poland could potentially consider acquiring nuclear weapons as the only means of guaranteeing its own security, particularly in the context if there were to be a change of administration in the United States. At the beginning of next year. So that question about nuclear weapons is one question. And then obviously a wider question, if you could just share with us your sense of how Poles feel in terms of the insecurity and threat from Russia and how that's changed since the invasion of Ukraine.
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. It's an important debate, important time as well. You asked me about the Polish, who said, I don't, of course, speak to, for the government, but here is what I like to contribute to this thinking. I mean, there is, of course, a dramatic difference between the situation of Poland and that of Ukraine. Ukraine is not a member of NATO, it's not covered by Article 5. It's as simple as that. This is something which we in Poland regret. Poland has been in the vanguard of pushing. First, when we speak of 2007 and 8, that was, of course, relatively early days. And so it's observed that there was still, not everybody in Ukraine was of course, fully on board, and various things have happened. But Poland has been and continues to be one of the strongest supporters of inviting or accelerating now, because there is, again, in principle, that sort of, invitation would like to see Ukraine in aid and so on. But yes, Olena is right. It has not been followed by more specific. I mean, there are no kind of, timelines, etc. And the reason is very simple. NATO works on the basis of consensus. And right now, irrespective of the views of such countries like Poland, Baltic countries, some others, there is no such consensus. And I think it's not to be very, very blunt. I think it's not terribly likely that there will be such consensus by the time of the summit in Washington. So that's the bad news, if you like. However, it is still the case that NATO with Poland as an active member, we just celebrated 25 years of membership, and also we've just celebrated the inclusion of Sweden. So now with Finland and Sweden, NATO is getting stronger as an organization, and it has no matter, I mean, regardless of the fact, I can understand this is not considered good enough. It does not meet the Ukrainian expectations. But NATO has been doing a lot of absolutely unprecedented things, and it will continue to do so. Ukraine has to rely. There is no other option. There is no magic wand on the support when it comes to, financial support, when it comes to, of course, economic support, but it also comes to the military support. At the moment, yes, being, again, putting my few pennies on the table, when it comes to what President Macron has said, it was an interesting take, because the purpose, and that's quite clear, is to kind of make life more difficult for the people in the Kremlin. Because for too long, we have been living in a situation when they kind of call the shots. As far as, for example, the nuclear threats, we've been living with them, Poland, since, I don't know, 20 years. People forget, but there was this very heated debate on missile defense, which, by the way, system, which is taking shape, it would become operation literally in a couple of months in Poland. We've been threatened nuclear annihilation by Russians for years and years. We have a long-term experience of this, and we know why Putin is doing this. Indeed, is to scare the people and to kind of weaken the resolve. The nuclear weapons themselves, again, there's an interesting case of South Korea, which, of course, is not a member of NATO. It's a country in the Pacific, but it has a very strong security arrangement with the United States. And even though U.S., this administration has kind of stepped up even the nuclear signal by, for example, having a nuclear capable submarine participate in exercise and so on, even the people in the South Korean government have started talking about the possibility potentially of even South Korea acquiring. I mean, that's still a long way to go, but this is still a different situation, because if you are a country that is a member of NATO, you basically rely, that is your main insurance. That is the policy. This is the way you organize your collective defense. You secure your defense via collective defense, and that part of that is a nuclear, if you like, umbrella provided by US and partially also by UK and France. So there are some discussions concerning enlarging, and I think Poland will be pushing for it, enlarging the so-called nuclear sharing. So it still does not change the fact there are only three nuclear powers in NATO: US, UK, and France. But other countries are playing a role. And I think Poland has some suggestions in that regard. But right now, I think, there's always kind of out-of-the-box thinking, but I don't see any signs that Poland will suddenly say. I mean, all these doomsday scenarios, as far as NATO is concerned, including what would happen if the new, previous U.S. president became the president again, there has been various statements which, of course, make people worry, such as that kind of, please put in doubt a little bit the automaticity of Article 5. But the truth is, this is the alliance we have, and this is the alliance we have to work with, and we want to. There is an issue, and that was one of the key interesting elements of a just concluded visit of both the Polish president and the Polish prime minister were in the US. And even on the question of which was raised by the Polish president, Polish prime minister, what about perhaps even increasing the size of U.S. military presence in Poland? There is no appetite for this right now. In U.S., we have to live with the political realities, and local politics is always strongest. That's something which everybody has to understand. You have to make appeals. You have to argue case. And of course, I take the point, and I kind of. commiserate with our Ukraine colleagues, because it's much easier to make your case when you're inside. That's the case. We are making the case for Ukraine. The same goes for the 3% increase. Right now, even not everybody is meeting the 2%. So there is the European angle as well. And it's not by chance tomorrow there's a meeting of the Weimar Triangle, so to speak. So the Polish Prime Minister will meet with the German and the French Chancellor and the President. So the political fight to support Ukraine, and also we could speak about ammunition. There is a special initiative strongly supported also by Poland, so-called Czech initiative. We need to deal with all the contingencies. And right now, of course, there is a problem because, one party is blocking some group of people in the US Congress is blocking a major assistance package. So various solutions we have to find. But what has not changed, and that was expressed today, at the presentation of so-called annual report by the Secretary General, that we know that Ukrainians are they're just as heroic as they have been. That has not changed. It's us, if you like, NATO, but also European Union, that have to step up, and that's what we're fighting for. That's something which, in some respects, even the situation is more challenging, but the actual I think the sense of urgency has become greater also in the part of Western Europe, which has been missing somewhat. I'll stop there, I think.
Okay, just a quick follow-up. You mentioned the defense expenditure. Poland is now by far the biggest spender on defense of any of the bigger countries in NATO. In fact, I think it's after the United States, it is as a percentage of GDP. But because your GDP has grown more rapidly than other European countries, in real terms, your spending has come closer to countries like Italy and Spain. Has that given Poland more influence within NATO? Along with the fact that the warnings from Poles over the years about Russia have shown to be correct?
I would like to say yes, but it's not really always the case. Perhaps it should be. And it's not just Poland. I put it bluntly, we were right before 2020. We were right, 10 years ago in terms of the analysis and so on. And we were right today. On the question of spending, of course, there will always be a difference. Poland has become, when it joined, a frontier state, de facto. Okay, it sort of replaced in that role Germany. Let us remind, US listeners, what was the situation during the Cold War. Of course, a country like Germany, who was a par excellence a frontier state, spent more than 40%. That's natural. But let's not forget, US, of course, spent huge amounts. But other European countries, allies, as it happens, also members of the European Union, which didn't exist at the time, they were spending also above 3%. That is not the case today. So that is a problem, because all the things we want to do, increase the production capacity. In fact, make sure that those units that we require for under the defensive plans, that they properly manned, that they properly equipped, and so on. They require money. Even European Union budgets. Keep returning to this. They also come most of the time from ministers of defense budgets. So this is a big fight, because if we don't deal with this problem, there are still too many countries that have not made it the 2%, which is the bare minimum. In fact, we now should be talking about 3%. And that has consequences, because if you don't spend, then there is no magic wand. The money will not just grow on trees. So in other words, that is of absolutely fundamental importance, both for our support to Ukraine, who is already the country, is de facto defending our security, but also for providing for our collective defense. So we have a sort of second burden sharing problem in Europe. We have the one which has always been there between Europeans and Americans. And by the way, Canadians are kind of also not doing everything they could. Three G7 countries, Canada, Germany, and Italy, which are still spending well below 2%. So, but we now have the second one. So this is one of the issues that we will hear more and more. It's not just President Trump, former President Trump, who keeps banging this. This is fundamental, because without this, a lot of things will not be able to happen. And therefore, various creative ideas about creating new structures, all the rest of it, they'll be just fluff, to be very blunt. They may help, but they will not resolve the problem. There is a need to be, and the starting point has to be a realization that the war in Europe is no longer unthinkable. It's as simple as that. And that concerns, has implications for a lot of countries, Ireland included, or Switzerland for the matter. You know, I mean, neutrality these days, it's a very different concept than it was before.
Now that's a perfect moment to go to Owen. Owen, from your perspective in Finland, you might give us a sense of how people in Finland perceive the threat, how that perception has changed, and relatedly, how Finland went from decades, like Ireland, decades of being military non-aligned and not a member of NATO. Within months, the debate within Finland changed, and Finland, of course, joined a year ago. You wouldn't talk us through perceptions and how that debate changed after the invasion.
Yes, so I often use I did an interview for the BBC the day Finland joined NATO. I used the Keynes quote, when the facts change, I change my mind. And with Finland, that the facts in European security changed, not just with Russia's escalated aggression in February 2022, but just before that, with some of the ultimatums that Russia was issuing. You know, no new members in NATO, and NATO's military infrastructure, which has always been scalable. I think Robert will be familiar with that term from his NATO days, in Central and Eastern Europe, has always been scalable and relatively light, that a lot of that military infrastructure in the newer member states would be wheeled back. So it wasn't Finnish and Swedish policymakers have spoken about it since. Sauli Niinistö, the former president, until recently, has spoken about it. I've heard Sweden's Minister of Defense, Paul Jonsson, discuss how this set off alarm bells in ministries across Stockholm and across Helsinki, that the Russians were really trying to alter the gravity of the European security system with these demands. And this could have serious knock-on effects for Finnish and Swedish freedom of action. Previously, the Finns and the Swedes understood kind of an unspoken arrangement. They calculate the strategic balance, the strategic environment very, very carefully up here. They pay very close attention to it. It's a huge difference in terms of the public debate to the debate we have in Ireland, for instance, which is primarily driven, I would argue, through domestic politics. So the strategic environment is very, very important. And the Finns and the Swedes saw it. They had strong independent defense capacities. They were full members of the West through their EU membership and their relations with the United States, their bilateral relations with the United States and their NATO partnerships. And up until late 2021, they thought that was satisfactory to maintain this stable regional balance. But all of that seemed to be drifting away from them in these Russian ultimatums. And who knows what ultimatums Russia might get in the future if it could bend the EU and the United States to its will on this occasion. So the public saw that very, very clearly, and the debate kind of really kicked into gear by then. And we saw a resounding reversal in public opinion. Publics here are quite well informed. I work for an institute that is funded by the state to provide fair and balanced analysis. But again, another little Irish parallel here, perhaps, and maybe with some other countries too. In Northern Europe, it was often is cliche about Norway that the Norwegians thought that it was good for everyone else, Central Eastern European states in the 1990s, 2000s. They were advising them to join the European Union, but the Norwegians weren't willing to join the European Union themselves. And I think it was a little bit like that with Finland and Sweden as well, in the sense that they saw NATO enlargement into the Baltic states, into Central and Eastern Europe, 1999, 2004. They saw that as very, very positive for stability in Europe. No problem. And they were certainly approving of the Baltic states taking up NATO membership and countries like Poland and other Visegrad states as well. They saw this as positive for the region. They were unwilling to join themselves, as I mentioned, because of the way they weighed up the strategic balance. That that arrangement changed. So NATO enlargement for Finland and Sweden, it adds an extra layer of deterrence. And there has been discussion already on nuclear weapons and nuclear deterrence. So much of the discussion here in Finland, certainly, and also Sweden as well, to an extent, has been on conventional deterrence. So as we know, Finland has got a very strong army, you know, strong defense forces. Its professional core of that army is 22,000, but it's got a reserve from its population that it can rapidly mobilize. So that stands at 280,000 that they can rapidly mobilize. And when they fully mobilize, they've got 900,000 or thereabouts personnel under arms. So conventional deterrence. They also have, the Turks sometimes debate this with me, but it's a toss-up between Finland and Turkey as to who has the largest artillery system in NATO now. So there's a lot of heavy metal there. And we've seen artillery with the war in Ukraine. We've seen artillery. Russia has brought artillery back into fashion. So Finland, for a small state, with its very significant artillery system, can meet fire with fire and can deter defense independently itself to a very large extent. Nevertheless, this argument comes up here quite a lot that you don't want Russians to incur. And what we've seen in Ukraine, the Russians are willing to take risks far beyond we were expecting them to. And when they incur, they wreck the place and they commit all sorts of horrible war crimes that will leave scars on, you know, this will leave psychological scars in Ukraine for decades. What we've seen in Bucha, Irpin, Mariupol, Kherson, you know, the list of Ukrainian cities and atrocities just goes on and on and on. So nobody in Finland and Sweden wanted to see that, particularly Finland, wanted to see that replicated on their territory. So it has brought a fairly significant U-turn in Finland, in the Finnish view on nuclear deterrence as well, that they need this extra layer of nuclear deterrence. And they could only get that by joining an international organization like NATO, to ensure that their deterrence is watertight at all levels, from the conventional level to the nuclear level. So that's really the state of play right now in Finland.
Excellent. And just the scale of the armed forces and the mobilization capacity for a country that's the same size and population as Ireland, the Republic, is extraordinary. Just one follow-up. Is there any residual anti-NATO sentiment in Finland? Or suspicion of NATO is quite prevalent in Ireland?
Not too much, no. As I said, that there were the former foreign minister here was quite skeptical, a kind of a giant of Finnish foreign policy in years past, a guy called Erkki Tuomioja. We've had presidents in the past, so before Halonen, before Niinistö, we had Tarja Halonen, who was for a more accommodationist, balanced foreign policy. That took Russia's views more into account. So we had this in the past within the debate, but now, and as I mentioned, NATO was seen objectively here as enlargement in neighboring countries was seen as positive. This is what the majority of Finnish people wanted, this strategic adjustment. So people who are anti-NATO are very much on the fringes. Nevertheless, there are some tests for this coming up. There's a new defense, bilateral defense cooperation agreement between the United States and Finland. We might see a stronger US and UK presence in Finland. How will certain politicians react to that? I would say that there won't be really any controversy, that the political system and public opinion will understand, because Finland and Sweden have been taking part in NATO exercises very, very intensively for the last 10 or 15 years or so. And the Americans and the UK armed forces have been regular visitors here, and the public understand the role that these two powers in particular and other powers within NATO have played in the region to stabilize the region and to deter. So it is an era of consensus here internally.
Okay, let me, Let me just stop you there. We've only got 15 minutes left. I want to get a couple of rounds of questions in. So I'm going to ask the three of you maybe to keep your answers to the following questions, maybe to 2 minutes, if at all possible. And Elena, can I go back to you? There's an awful lot of discussion, obviously, about assistance to Ukraine in military terms, but there's also considerable assistance in non-military terms. Could you give a sense of how significant the assistance to Ukraine is in non-military terms, in terms of keeping public services running, keeping morale going? Any sort of sense about that you can share with us? And you're muted.
Yeah, of course, it is very significant. As you know, the budget of Ukraine right now is around 80 billion euro. And actually, half of it goes to defense. And the way the arrangement is right now, that Ukraine receives different kinds of microfinancial assistance in the form of loans, concessional loans, IMF loans, different other IFIs projects and grants from European Union, from the United States. And so altogether, when we receive all that assistance, we direct it towards social services, towards non-military things, but our own taxpayer money we spend on military procurement. That's the way it is arranged right now in Ukraine. And of course, it is very significant because Ukrainian economy now is existing under full-scale invasion. Ukraine has huge demographic challenge now. Millions of Ukrainians left the country. Businesses function, but they don't have enough clients sometimes, not enough revenue. And for us, this war, it's very clear that we need to maintain their economy. Moreover, not only we need to maintain the economy to keep making money for the war, but we also need to put our economy on a war footing. And Ukraine has not yet done that. But Russia has done it more successfully, I would argue. So we
Elena,
need together. That's it.
Elena, why has the economy not shifted onto a war footing, given the overused term existential? But this is clearly an existential crisis. As you say, Russia wants to end Ukrainian statehood.
Yes, because Ukraine, I think Ukraine was overwhelmed by this event, by their invasion 2 years ago, and was not really prepared for that. And it took some time. It took us time to, for example, my organization, we work in the field of defense industry, where we are creating defense infrastructure for different startups, where we're making new drones, new weapons. It took us time, but just because there was some inertia, and main reason was because Ukraine did not believe that it will be invaded. That's the main reason.
Right.
Ukraine
okay.
did not believe. Yeah.
Robert, could we jump over to you to quote President Macron again? A few years ago, he famously described NATO as being brain dead. As somebody who worked in NATO for a long time, could you give a sense of how NATO, the dynamic within the discussion has changed, the dynamic as an organization has changed over the past 2 years?
It has changed. It's changed for sure. I mean, at the time President Macron made this into for economies, I mean, it didn't go down well, I can tell you, you know, NATO HQ. First, because it was frankly unfair. You know, I mean, it's NATO is a classical intergovernmental organization. Let's emphasize this. There is no elements which you can compare to, I don't know, European Commission, for example. Nothing happens in NATO. Everything has to be approved by the nations. So if somebody has a problem because, you know, NATO is perhaps not doing the things it should be or whatever, well, you argue a case, but very often it's the same countries who kind of block certain things. And then they say, you know, I mean, give an example. This is a very important debate going on right now in the context of European efforts. And I'm not saying it's a bad idea. It's in fact, perhaps it is a good idea. It's actually important to increase the role that European structures play in improving the production, you know, the defense production. But the truth is, NATO also has its own production pledge. The problem is that, you know, what we've seen, something that has been unveiled, I mean, last week, okay, it's been long overdue, half a year delay, very difficult to understand in EU, but it has been. And you see various points which boil down to the fact that there should be a kind of a positive discrimination that, you know, countries should only buy, you know, or the majority of the purchase should be done in Europe. Well, that obviously contradicts what is happening within NATO. And these are pretty fundamental questions because NATO, you know, nothing is perfect. I mean, there are certain realities of the day that need to be taken account. So it's irregardless of President Trump, whatever new administration will govern, so to speak, in Washington, there will be more. Let's not forget about this. There'll be more effort put, more weight put on the relationship, and therefore also including military responsibilities when it comes to the Indo-Pacific. And Europeans have to take into account. There's some very simple ideas, but right ideas, some really clever people on the US and other side, which is that Europeans should basically take care of 50% of the collective defense burden, not 100%. But at the same time, to come back to your question, President Macron, if you go too far, if you start saying, you know, it's all NATO is kind of doomed and gloom and whatever, then you might actually undermine the best, collective defense and the best insurance security, organization in the world, because the transatlantic links are irreplaceable. And certainly anybody who says that Europeans could replace to the same level of security, you know, NATO by replacing somehow by magic, you know, U.S. contribution. I'm living in cuckoo land. That will take years and years and years. But at the same time, the burden has to shift. The Europeans have to carry more burden, not in order to replace NATO, but in order to beef up its own contribution. And it's as simple and as complicated at the same time as it is. So I think, you know, judging by the recent, if you like, activism of France, that's also very notable. Our French colleagues have become one of the much, and it's for real. It's for real. People have doubts, but I think it's fair to say France has shifted its position on supporting Ukraine. So that shows actually creative thinking. You know, so President Macron has criticized NATO a few years ago. Now he's actually proving NATO. That's a good development.
And Robert, very, very quickly, in terms of Donald Trump's recent statements saying that Russia could do what it wants, how significant has that been, and how great a fear is there that effectively NATO, as it currently as it has existed for decades, might no longer exist within a short period of time?
Well, first of all, President Trump has to win elections, and that's in the hands of U.S. voters, and we don't know. It's a democracy. The case for actually maintaining NATO, and that's also, for example, people like my president, my prime minister, who just been in the U.S., been making very strong, also in the capital. Yes. Europeans benefit enormously from U.S. security presence and leadership, de facto, in NATO. But Americans are benefiting too, you know, and it's not just a question of, yes, making money in defense. Well, a lot of defense companies are making money these days because we have the war. But it's you know, a stark reminder. The only time NATO has activated Article 5, you know, the famous, really, the gist of NATO, right, was 2001, following the attack on U.S., So it's just, you know, U.S. gets enormous benefits from this, and the case has to be made by everybody because the transatlantic link is kind of irreplaceable, regardless of the type of challenges we know that we're facing today, but also those we don't know, right? So it's something to be cherished, nurtured, and yes, because these are democracies, there has to be a bit of political battle to make sure that everybody stays on the same line. But the condition of NATO, and this is the last sentence, irrespective of those challenges, problems, and sometimes loose language, let's call it that way, is actually much better than it was a few years ago. We're doing the kind of things, the biggest exercise since the Cold War, which was unthinkable a few years ago. So NATO has changed, as it always has, and we are heading in the right direction, but a lot of, you know, because of the threat, the acuteness of the threat, we need to do more and quicker. That's the challenge.
Thanks. Owen, to you, in terms of those who are most threatened, you know the Baltic states very well. You've been involved in them, and you live very close to them, just across the water from Helsinki. There is a theory, a sort of domino theory, a new domino theory, that if Russia is not defeated in Ukraine, then it's almost inevitable, or it's high, much higher risk that it will attack other countries. And of course, the Baltics are probably the most vulnerable. What's your assessment of that idea that if Russia isn't defeated in Ukraine, that it will move towards the Baltics? How high a probability do you see of a military incursion into one of the Baltic, one or more of the Baltic countries in the future?
Well, I think that probability stands on how strong NATO is. If NATO stands at its current strength and gets stronger as it has been now under Biden, then I think the probability is low. But there is that uncertainty with the political cloud of a second Trump presidency hanging over us. So, I mean, trying to get into Vladimir Putin's mind has become a cottage industry among experts, think tankers, pundits, academics, etc. And how Vladimir Putin himself thinks about these things. You know, some suggestions, you know, they say Putin is a providential leader. And after he's met some of his goals, if he's allowed to do that in Ukraine, that he would like a crack at NATO, to maybe use an Irish term at that. And really to weaken NATO, to really, you know, vengefully take revenge on NATO for what he sees as on the narrative, the myth that Russians put out, that NATO enlargement was taking advantage of them when they were weak during the 1990s and early 2000s, that, you know, all he needs to do is to incur on NATO territory and test NATO's Article 5. If he thinks Article 5 is going to work, he won't do it. If he thinks it is unlikely to work and that allies will shirk their responsibilities, then he is more likely to do it. And as you mentioned, the Baltic states are the most vulnerable part of the alliance, but they're not completely vulnerable. I mean, they have built up their armed forces independently, considerably in recent years. You know, Estonia never abolished conscription. It's got a very similar mobilization structure to Finland. Not as big, doesn't have the same heavy metal with artillery. Latvia just reintroduced conscription, and Lithuania reintroduced conscription in 2015. There's multinational NATO battle groups in the region. None. The US lead the battle group in Poland, but none are US led. So one is UK led, the one in Estonia, multinational, of course, other countries are involved. One is Canadian led, and one is in Lithuania. The Latvian one is Canadian led, the Lithuanian one is German led. So it was seen at the time, I remember when we moved, Robert will remember this, in 2014 from the Readiness Action Plan to the Enhanced Forward Presence. It was emphasized at that time that it's very important that it's multinational, that it's NATO in it together, NATO collectively, and not just the United States and the United Kingdom that we rely on. So the United States is a big player in the region. We rely, Europeans, Robert was kind of alluding to this, we rely on the United States for many enablers and many logistics if we need to move more NATO forces to deter or to defend. So the United States would be a big loss, but there still is reinforcements there as well at the same time. But yes, it will depend on how strong NATO. How strong NATO's collective defense is, and very much that is in NATO's hands right now. That is in the hands of NATO's members, not in the hands of Vladimir Putin. This is under our control in the West, and that should be remembered.
Okay, and we're almost at the end. Oh, and I can't let you go. I know you pay a close attention to your country of origin. How do you assess Ireland's response to the changed security situation in Europe over the past few years?
Slow and indecisive, but at least these days, at least now, we're having a debate, and I hope that debate can flower. Of course, the Irish threat environment is very different. We're talking about hybrid threats in our airspace, in our maritime zones, and in cyber security. So the debate really needs to develop both at the academic level and in the policy level. I don't think we'll be seeing any amphibious landings at Curacao Beach, any land warfare in Ireland. And one thing I think we need to be wary of, I mentioned Britain a few times, Britain's role in Northern Europe, Britain's role in the Baltic States. Britain is stretched in terms of its public finances, in terms of the pressure with its political system. Right now, its political system There's a lot of uncertainty there. And, you know, on the hush-hush, we have a habit of relying too much on Britain for our defence. And with Britain stretched, we will need to do more. And this is not just in the Irish national security interests, with Britain playing a very important role in Europe. It's also in the European and transatlantic security interests. So these hard realities, these responsibilities, I think, need to be better understood in Ireland.
Thank you for that. Elena, final word. What hope do you have of peace in your country, and over what sort of time frame?
Peace in our country, our people, Ukrainians, we are fighting. Like, our people are very brave, fighting like tigers, really, without weapons or with weapons. However, we rely very much on Europe right now, because this war is not against Ukraine. It's against Europe. It's against the West-dominated international rule-based order. And right now, Ukraine is buying time for Europe with the lives of our people. Russia is going to attack Europe in one form or the other, sooner or later. And if Ukraine is defeated, it will happen really soon.
Thank you. We've hit just gone a minute over our allotted time. I'd like to thank our three panelists for sharing their views with us today. Much appreciated. Thank you all, and thank our audience for joining. Have a good rest of the day. Thanks.